नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संगं नमस्सामि। For those of you that don't know, that's a homage chant. I'm paying reverence to the teacher, paying homage to the teacher, the Buddha, the Blessed One, the awakened teacher of gods and humans. So the basket is empty. This is how we would like to be, like an empty basket. There's an image that's helpful to use, and I try to follow this in establishing a community. It's something I learned from the Ajahn Chah legacy. Ajahn Chah himself advised that we should be like a rubbish bin with a hole in it. But if there's no hole, then it fills up, and then we're full of rubbish. Just contemplate. In daily life, we take the rubbish out every day. It's usually something under the kitchen sink. If you go and visit someone and you want to toss something in the rubbish, you can almost be sure that you can open that cupboard and there'll be a little rubbish bin there. And we empty it often, but how often do we empty the rubbish bin within us? How much rubbish are we carrying around? And this is an age of recycling. But we don't want to keep recycling our old rubbish. And we do. We do that through memory, through clinging, attachment, holding on. We're constantly recycling old stories of suffering, of blame, of hurt, of unfairness, of mistakes. Others, mostly other people, have made mistakes, and we're busy reviewing those. Or our own failings, and we're our worst critics, our own worst critics. So, when I look at emptiness, empty containers, empty baskets, empty rubbish bin, it reminds me of what's a good policy to follow? And that is to empty out the rubbish in the mind and not to collect, not to be a collector of rubbish. We have many ways of collecting. And interestingly enough, I didn't know anything about this feature or this manifestation in our modern world called hoarding. I didn't really know much about it until very recently. And it seems to be quite common, but I really, in years gone by, I'd never ever heard of someone called a hoarder. And all of us have really been doing that in one way or another. But then, now there are more intensive styles of hoarding where a person would continually buy things, consume and buy, and until their living space is crowded out with stuff. But that might describe most of us. Most of us have a lot of stuff. And so you get where I'm going with this. As nuns, we as monastics, we don't collect a lot of stuff. And this is a very liberating way of living. So we have our robes and our bowl. We have four requisites. We have a shelter, usually. Although there are many monastics that make a practice of wandering from place to place. And they basically carry their luggage with them, whatever it is. There are a lot of young people that do that too. There are older people that do that as well. There are homeless people that do that. But they do it more out of a sense of adventure. Not homeless people, I don't mean that. I mean that you see kids traveling around the world doing Airbnbs, things like that, to see the world. I did that as well about 40 years ago, rushing around the world to see things while I could. I thought it was because I'd be not capable physically. But now some of those places you can't even get into, or you wouldn't want to go there because there's countries in state of oppression, ruin, war, violence, or hostility. So this traveling through the journey of life with not much luggage can be an asset if it's not done in a state of deprivation and being forced out of your home, losing your job, your income, and having to live on the street. And for some people, that's become a reality. And then when you're living in that way, you're very vulnerable to street values and the dangers of that. But as monastics, we voluntarily simplify our lives and give up having much, living simply, living according to very strict but upholding structures, including precepts. So, and this is for our protection. These choices that we make are really to protect us from the values that might, or activities of the world that might lead us into holding on to things, clinging to things, being caught up in worldly activities and distractions that do not help us to purify our minds. So we have a different intention and aspiration in our lives, and this style of living helps us to accomplish that. But it's not just for monastics. And that's why this retreat setting is so apt for non-hoarding intention, non-hoarding of unskillful states of mind and unskillful attachments, unskillful mental habits or processes that keep leading us into distractedness or leading us into unskillful interactions with ourselves or with others. When we wear the robe, it's so simple, yet it's pretty hard to keep on your body. I invite you all to try. You just take a rectangular sheet and you you roll it and roll it and roll it, and then you flip it. You tighten. There's no buttons. So if you let go, it just unravels. It does, really. It really does. Isn't, doesn't it, sister? And I was telling a group recently that one of our elders, elder teachers, took care of his mother for many years, and she used to imitate her son, the monk. This was imitation of the monk. He's always trying to keep your robe on your shoulder. But the reason for this, one begins to learn. At first one thinks it's very inconvenient. Why didn't the Buddha just... And in fact, in other traditions, the monastics wear a style of robe that is pretty easy to keep on your body. But we follow the... We're the diehards, you know. We want to do it exactly the way the Buddha did. And so to the dimensions, width, length of the cloth to your body size, and absolutely no strings attached. Except for a little tiny thing at the bottom to keep it from flapping in the wind. But this doesn't help. So what's the meaning of this? So the meaning of the robe for me, it's a mindfulness practice, because you always have to be aware of keeping it on your body. And this has many shades of symbolism for me. One of them is that I have to stay aware of staying on the path, keep my awareness of being on the path and following the teacher. So there's always this action of adjusting and tightening the robe around my being so that I can't stray too far from the decorum and the etiquette required of keeping the robe close to the body, correctly attached to the body, formed around the body, looking neat and clean. And not flapping in the wind, and not dropping or dragging, and especially in a place where there are ticks. This is good to keep your robes off the ground. So, but you know, the ticks of the world are not insects. The poisons of the world are easily attached to us if we get too close to them. So the robe becomes a symbol of protection, not to drag ourselves around in dirty places. And that doesn't mean just that somebody spilled coffee on the floor, but keeping the company of beings that live well, that follow a path of kindness, that are on a journey which is inspiring, who live a life which is directed towards wholesomeness, virtue, restraint, kindness, selflessness, and spiritual aspiration. I'm sure that all of you are here for something like that. And or maybe it's just a pleasant way to spend Saturday afternoon. But so the robe is a symbol of that intention and that attention to how we are right now. Because you can't move very far without paying attention to the way the robe is in relationship to the body. Somebody asked, why do you all wear different colored robes? It doesn't matter so much about the color, just like there are many colored flowers in nature. This is just a product of different dyes, different fabrics, and different tastes. But But basically the Buddha said to wear a shade of brown, except for the color of dead leaves. And I wondered about that. And then in the fall, I once looked at some dead leaves and I thought, it's a pretty difficult color, that. It's, for some reason, it does look lifeless. And we don't want to look dead. We want to die to our greed, hatred, and delusion. But it's nice to do so in a fresh and bright way, using something that brightens the heart. So we're not gloomy looking and unattractive in a wholesome way. In terms of wholesomeness, I don't mean in terms of, we're not trying to be physically attractive, but we also don't want to be repulsive. So there's enough to contemplate on repulsiveness in the body, within the body. And in fact, we do contemplations on the body as repulsive. And this is a way of cooling the mind from lust or from being carried away with sensual desire, which is very important for a monastic. But it's also very important for anyone practicing a spiritual path to find a way to cool our attraction to worldly pleasure. Because the pleasantness of the world can lead us far away from restraint, far away from one-pointedness, far away from making skillful choices. Even if we think that we can guard our minds, control our minds, and do what we know is good for us, how many times have we found ourselves doing quite the opposite? Or leaning not in that direction? No? If this does not ring true to you, please raise your hand. Nobody's raising their hand. Yeah. So the robe is made in a very methodical way with paddy fields, paths and fields. And these fields or these rectangles represent the fields that the Buddha saw before him at one time when he was walking with his attendant Ananda. And most of the renunciants at that time who were wearing robes had some marking of their robe, and the Buddha wanted his disciples to have something that was very easy for them to identify each other with and not be mistaken for someone of a different tradition or school. So he asked Ananda, how would it be to use that pattern of the rice fields of Magadha, the paddy fields? And Ananda said that would certainly be a good idea. So I look at these fields and I think of our practice as a field of goodness. And I think of these areas, these borders, little boundaries around the rectangles, which have to be a certain centimeters related to the diameter, the width and the dimensions of the field. And these paths for me represent our precepts, our training, whatever our training might be. We're not training to be engineers or cooks, but we are in another way. We're engineering a path of safety through the undergrowth, the dangers of the world. And these paths, if we stay on them, then we're right in this, the whole robe is a field of goodness. But these fields in the robe are, have many paths going through them. So there are many, many ways of goodness to be practiced, many skills to be learned. And if we follow them, we stay in this field of goodness. So I really love wearing the robe for that. It's such an excellent flag, a symbol of the practice and all the many aspects of it. Then we have our bowls. And the bowl, as we showed you before, contains our food for the day. And the bowl that we're developing here, we're firing, this is a very good image, firing the bowl of the mind. We're firing it. What does that mean? If you fire a pot, like a clay pot, and in the time of the Buddha they may have very well used clay pots or breakable bowls, it gives it strength to fire it. Our bowls are made of stainless steel at this time, but the first bowl I had was not. It was a clay bowl and it was breakable. And Ayanima was quite lucky. She didn't have to carry a clay pot for 5 years. I never broke it, but it was fired, so it had a little bit of extra strength in it. But if you knocked it the wrong way, if you weren't mindful at any second, carrying it hither and thither, walking for alms in the street, going upstairs, going through doors, it could be smashed very quickly. So we're firing the bowl of the heart by using the tools that the Buddha teaches us, developing mindfulness, present moment awareness, using right effort, guarding the skillful qualities of the mind, developing them, expanding them, enlarging them, and at the same time bringing into consciousness those skillful qualities that we have not yet developed. So we increase our repertoire of skill in goodness. And the other effort that we hone in this practice is to abandon unskillful qualities. And this is every day, whenever we're moving, sitting, walking, awake, interacting, alive, not asleep. And even in our sleep, try to go to sleep skillfully, have mindfulness in sleep, not thrashing around or letting the mind wander into hell realms or fantasy land. So even then, just guarding the mind from that which harms it, breaks it, weakens it in the face of what the world is presenting to us. And we guard what consciousness is landing on and where the direction it's going in now. But we also try to prevent unskillful forces, energies, activities, and objects, or ways of paying attention to objects, or experiences that arise in consciousness. We try to prevent those from affecting us, from harming us. We try not to develop the mind in those unskillful ways. These efforts are to be practiced in our daily development of this meditation. So the heart becomes like a temple. It's a space. We protect it. It can easily be infiltrated. It can easily be poisoned and corrupted. How many times have we seen ourselves or people very dear to us get corrupted? our children, our parents. There's drugs, there's intoxicants, there's even medicines wrongly used. Start out like now, well, people take marijuana for medical purposes, but they also take marijuana for other purposes, which can lead one to overindulgence in food. Right? But we don't need marijuana to overindulge in food. That's something that the whole world seems to have excelled in and keeps promoting. So then, and then we have the results of that. And the results are suffering in the body, harm to the body. So overindulging from the point of view of the mind can also weaken our practice, weaken our ability to withstand the insults and attacks of sensual pleasure and sensual activities. So firing the heart is this kind of way of holding our attention, holding it with our aspiration well focused, to be present, to be continuous, to be diligent, to be vigilant, to be enthusiastic in the good, enthusiastic, eager, yearning, having this kind of a chanda. This is an earnest wish to develop in skillfulness, in wholesomeness, as a way of protecting ourselves. So we can abide in a field of goodness. And then into the bowl, the alms bowl, come many offerings that people give us for our daily meal. Sometimes people offer us not enough, and sometimes they offer us too much. And of course the mind can react to that. Sometimes life gives us not enough. Sometimes life gives us too much of what we don't want, or even too much of what we want. When we get too much of what we want, what happens? It can make us sick, or we get fed up with it. At first, we really wanted it. Like, how much ice cream can you eat before you feel sick? And how much time can you spend on the computer? People never seem to get... What are those programs doing to our minds? We begin to get so addicted to the time on the computer that we suffer when we're not checking every day. Now, in these latter years, I notice everybody, everywhere I go, everybody has a cell phone. But this is quite new. It didn't used to be that way. True? Yeah. So what happened all of a sudden? Some clever person invented a cell phone and is getting really rich. Or a few. No, it's not one person. Okay, I'm a little naive in this area, but the economics of it must be pretty obvious. These companies have us by the throat. We are sold, we are slaves to their products. We are lining up to get the latest apps, the latest models, the latest connectivity. You too can have your own private cloud. I saw this at the airport. I thought, really? That's impossible. But that's what's being advertised. I don't even know what it means. But it's something about data, right? Data. Well, what about the data in the heart? how do we protect that? What kind of security do we have to protect our most precious data? It's not electronic, and it's not electronically or digitally connected to anything. And yet, it is the most powerful knowledge that we can possess, or that we can inculcate into our being, into the heart, into embed within us. We want to fire that knowledge into us so that it is not separate from our every waking moment, so that we don't move or act from a place that does not begin with the Dhamma, begin with wholesomeness, begin with the understanding and the connection to truth. Proceed through the Dhamma. Proceed from that place of goodness, from that connection to wholesomeness, integrity, compassion, and wisdom. Does not develop, if it does not develop from that, and it does not flower in that, if it does not come to its consummation through the qualities of the Dhamma, through the qualities of deep and profound virtue, stillness, and wisdom, we must protect ourselves from losing that ability, or from not gaining in the field of goodness. This is the most precious thing that we can guard. And yet, we are addicted to and enslaved in guarding data that just weakens us and makes us impoverished. We cannot live without these contraptions, devices. They are vices. They're devices. It's an interesting word. Do you have a device? What vice do you have? The best vice in the world. It's a smart. It's something smart. But it's not smart at all. It has no wisdom. And we actually believe that this is innocuous. This kind of, you know, now they're pocket size, they're portable, you can take it anywhere with you. I see people walking and holding their devices and vices in ways that are a little bit arrogant, a little bit cocky, a little bit overconfident. I got the whole world in my hands. Literally. You can find out anything on your device. But not anything. Not everything. There is one field that we cannot pass through unless we put that device down. And it's not just this room. I don't know if they were not collected at the door. But in some centers, the devices are not allowed through the front door. You have to check it in. And then it takes people a couple of days to settle down because the habit is so strong to check, to look, to listen. Is there a little ding? Who's trying to text me? People must get me. I must be available. Or I must, you know, whatever thought comes up in the mind, we're able to act on it immediately with a broad sweep of the horizons of the whole world. It's like having the encyclopedia in your pocket, the dictionary of every profession. that you can think of in your pocket, except one. The profession, and I'm using it in the ancient Catholic way, if you're professed, it means you're a monastic. So I'm now transporting that into the Buddhist framework. We're professionals here. This is our profession. We're daughters of the Buddha. We want to wake up. We cannot wake up with a cell phone, a smartphone, even the latest model. Don't let anyone ever try to convince you, because one of these days, that someone told me there is a meditation app. There are many, just like the many traditions. So I don't use a meditation app. But I do apply my mind moment by moment, and I fire my mind meditatively using mindfulness, using right effort, using the purification through virtue, and allowing that wisdom to emerge so that I have insight into the way things are, into the truth of how things are. And the truth of how things are can help us realize that we're walking through a field of rubbish. The mind is in desperate need of firing, of clearing out, of cleansing, of deodorizing, of disinfecting, of salvation, rescue, refuge from pollutants, contaminants, addiction. We're all addicted. Maybe we're not taking fentanyl, but our addictions are probably killing us in one way or another. They're killing the truth that we are born to discover. What are we doing in this world? We're here to discover the truth. It resides within us, not out there, not in any kind of possessions, objects, external conditions. But it's through investigating our internal condition that we can have insight. And this insight is so panoramic. Imagine the what kind of a mind the Buddha had that he could understand the predicament of all human beings universally in such a way that he was able to transport his understanding into millennia beyond his day and age, so that this teaching penetrates into the reality of every human being's predicament, every animal being's predicament, every insect's predicament, every celestial being's predicament. He knew every realm. And he knew how to address our basic needs. Our basic needs are not hamburgers and cell phones, fast food and these devices. Our basic needs are not holiday time and sleeping whenever we want, or sensual delights. Those are not basic needs. Wearing the robe and carrying the bowl, we come to recognize that we had a whiff of it before we did take on the training. This is a training. But all of us can wear a robe, and all of us can carry a bowl. And the robe is the robe of the path, the robe of freedom from suffering, the robe of virtue, the robe of understanding and compassion. All of us can wear that. And all of us can fill the bowl of our hearts with those qualities until our minds are fully liberated and awakened. So to undertake the training, you don't have to dress like this, but we must dress with mindfulness, clear comprehension, all the many folds of the Eightfold Path, right view, right understanding, right view and right understanding. What is true and what is not? What is the way to truth and what is not? What is skillful and what is not? And then coming to that right view, we are able to develop right intention, right aim, right intent. This is how we direct the mind in a way that will help us to realize the best within us. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. It's a path of harmlessness from beginning to end. Safety, non-harming. Even a serial killer. You all know the story of Angulimala, the serial killer in the time of the Buddha, who was so gullible and deluded that he believed his teacher, who demanded of him a test, that he should go out and collect 1,000 fingers, a garland of 1,000 fingers, and present them to his teacher. And then he would pass the test and become a true disciple. I can't remember the specifics. But so he, against his better judgment, because he was conned by this malevolent, ill-directed advice, ill-begotten advice from a truly unwise being, he followed along with it, thinking that he might gain in some way that he didn't yet understand. And then when he was, he had killed 999 people, so he had that many fingers, and he was almost at the end of his test. He saw his mother, thought if he would kill his mother. And luckily, the Buddha, with his psychic ability, knew that this Angulimala was about to kill his mother. And he also could suss out Angulimala's spiritual potential. So he went to the area where Angulimala was walking, and he went in front of him, and Angulimala knew that the Buddha had entered the wood, and he tried to follow him, and the Buddha acted like a decoy. Instead of going to get his mother, he said, "I'll get this recluse." But he could not catch up with the Buddha. Even though the Buddha was walking quite normally and Angulimala was going as fast as he could, he was a very strong man. He couldn't catch up with him. So he yelled out, "Stop, O reckless, stop!" And the Buddha turned around and said to him, "I have stopped. Now you stop, Angulimala." And Angulimala, by the way, means 1,000 fingers. A garland of 1,000 fingers. He said, he decided to ask this recluse what he meant. And the Buddha explained to him that he had given up harming any living being. He had given up violence completely in action, in speech, even in thought. Now it was up to Angulimala to give that up. And so Angulimala was so stunned because he could see that this was true. This was no ordinary being speaking to him. And it suddenly he felt so repelled by his own horrific legacy of violence. He in humility fell in front of the Buddha on his knees and asked for the Buddha to take him as a disciple. So Angulimala became a monk after such a history of terrible murder. Never heard of 1,000 human beings being killed. Well, no, yes, have heard of millions of human beings being killed in a different way, with machines, with guns. But so really, he had done so much harm, and yet, once he recognized the harm that he had done, he could reform himself. He could turn his mind away from that and turn towards the spiritual path. And he ended up becoming an arahant, fully awakened being. There's a very beautiful chant that we do for women when they're in labor, and it's called the Angulimala chant. And you might think, why would you use a chant to such a ferocious human being for someone who's giving birth and in terrible pain? So, and of course, when Angulimala was during the time of the Buddha, when he was passing by a woman in labor, he wanted to help her because his great compassion had been awakened, and he wanted to relieve her of her pain. But he felt he didn't know how, so he went to the Buddha and asked, how can I help this woman? And the Buddha said, you should tell her that you have never killed any human being since you were born, never harmed any human being. And Angulimala said, how can I say that? I have harmed so many human beings. And the Buddha said, you have not harmed anyone since you have taken this noble birth as a monk. And then the chant is, by the power of this purity, may you be free from your pain. So, if we think that we have lived so heedlessly, if we think that we have squandered our abilities, our faculties, our powers in unwholesome ways, and we're not worthy somehow of these spiritual gains, think again. There is Angulimala as an example to us of how much we can let go of the past completely. Just turn away from it. And from this very moment, we can be the ones to ordain a new beginning, to proclaim for ourselves a new beginning, making an asseveration of truth. From this day forward, or a determination of truth, from this day forward, I will not harm any living being. That's a precept that we can take. That's the first precept for every human being. The definition of a human being for the Buddha is one who keeps the 5 precepts: not harming any living being, not taking that which is not given, not indulging heedlessly in any sensual pleasure, not speaking falsely or harmfully to anyone, and not polluting or poisoning the mind with any form of intoxicating substances that lead us to carelessness. So this is how we can turn ourselves away from the dangers of falling down in the world through hatred, through greed, through ill will, through hunger for power, through hunger for possessions, for success, for vantage, advantage, for privilege. Why do we harm people? Because we think that we can get something that we want. So not following that impulse of craving, but moving in ways that restrain and overcome and release instead our potential for purification in body, speech, and mind. So there's right speech, right action, right livelihood, even to the extent that we pursue a profession in the world that is not harmful, not harming. And then the wisdom component of the path is developing right effort, which we've been talking about today, right mindfulness, and right concentration of mind, leading to complete freedom from suffering. So all of us are capable of overcoming every form of addiction or enslavement or any kind of bad habit as long as we trust this practice. We have to come to it with a sense of yes, like Angulimala saw the truth of what the Buddha was saying. I have stopped. Now you stop. We can say to ourselves, I can stop. Whatever it is that we see brings a bad result for us in our life, even if it's just a bad mood. Why did we get into a bad mood? What created irritation? Why are we feeling streams of hate or jealousy or resentment or judgment? Why are we blaming others or ourselves? Why are we living heedlessly? We can, by following this practice and having faith in it, we see that we can stop that poor result and bring about a yield, a harvest of goodness within us. We just have to give ourselves to that process, invest in it, take time for it, not make excuses why we cannot do it, but instead blaze a trail for ourselves through the undergrowth of worldly activities and entanglements. If any of you have ever had to brush your hair, if you've had long hair, you know that you need to brush it. And if you brush it, you can get the knots out. If you have short hair, that's pretty cool. You don't have to use a brush. But your hair will still get dirty, greasy, oily, disgusting. We have to wash it, soap it, rinse it, and then make it look neat or shave it. Cut it. You can cut or shape or not. Whatever is, it gives a pleasing energy, a freshness. How do we shave the heart? How do we brush the mind? How do we cleanse internally? How do we do the laundry within? This is what it is, the Eightfold Noble Path. It's a path of ennobling ourselves, of building an internal temple. It's inner, but because the mind is so boundless, we don't know the limits of our minds. It's not the brain. It's not the heart organ. So the mind, just like the Buddha, through his mental ability, his mental strength, he could send his mind towards Angulimala's mind and know what he needed to do to rescue that being. We also can, through the power of our practice and the sublime abidings of unconditional loving kindness, unconditional compassion, unconditional rejoicing for the well-being and the happiness of others, and then unconditional balance, equanimity with all conditions. We can abide through those abidings in boundless ways that go well beyond the electromagnetic field of this body. We can send our love across the universe. And whether we believe that or not, if you study and know anything about electromagnetic waves, then think of this body as a field of electromagnetic energy, which it is. How can we possibly know the limits of it and the way we can develop that? So faith and trust in that ability, then we can move with mindfulness and bringing up the energy in the skillful, most skillful way. We can develop the stillness of mind to evacuate all the poisons, to cleanse deeply. You want deep cleaning? Deep cleansing? Here and now, Dhamma is the deepest, cleanest, shiniest of all. It's radiant. It's a radiation that can penetrate through every other realm of experience, right across the universe, boundless. So we can open our hearts to that and realize the complete freedom through insights, through seeing things just as they truly are. And this is knowing impermanence, suffering, and the emptiness of all of this. This is just like a magic show. But the real magic is the magic of the mind. So consider that and practice and see what the result is in your own heart. And then we offer that onto the shrine of the world. We offer that to ourselves and to all beings as a blessing. You can do it even when you're driving your car. What did she say? Yes, when you're driving your car, you can sit mindfully and you can be very heedful. You can be very present, holding the steering wheel, not pushy, just advancing little by little, moving, slowly arriving in one piece. But I mean arriving in one P-E-A-C-E. So arriving, I'm using the automobile as a metaphor for safely driving our vehicle. We have to manage it. We have to direct ourselves. We have to turn the wheel of Dhamma correctly, accurately, aspiring in a direction that leads in the way of truth, not in the way of the world. And that requires profound compassion for ourselves and others. Wisdom and compassion. So that's the path. And we can just get on with it. Let's take a short break and then we can sit together for the last 35 minutes.